Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Humanitarian Aesthetics and the Design of Displacement. I'm delighted to introduce to you our speaker for today, Tom Scott Smith, who is director of the Refugee Studies Center at the University of Oxford and is associate professor of forced migration. He has written two books on emergency relief and humanitarian design. They're titled On an Empty Stomach, 200 Years of Hunger Relief by Cornell University Press in 2020, and Fragments of Home, Refugee Housing and the Politics of Shelter by Stanford University Press that was out in 2024. He is general editor of the Bergen Books series Enforced Migration and his sequence of short documentaries about refugee shelter in Europe, Shelter Without Shelter, which came out in 2020, won the UK Arts and Humanities Research in Film Award in 2020. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you've done all this really interesting work on humanitarianism, and your latest book is on shelter design, quite broadly, and it looks at quite different contexts and approaches to design. So I wanted to start this conversation with asking you how you came to do this kind of work.
Yeah, so the immediate trigger for the research project that led to the book that I'm going to be talking about mostly, which is Fragments of Home, which you very kindly mentioned in your introduction. The trigger was 2015, which, as many listeners will know, was that famous summer of migration through Europe. And it was a period when emergency shelter really became a big and important issue in the media, because there were tens of thousands of refugees walking through Europe, coming through the Middle East, crossing borders, arriving in cities and towns, and all needing an immediate place to stay. And over that summer, I noticed that there was a real uptick of interest in the subject of accommodation for these refugees, particularly on the part of architects and designers, who I think quite understandably wanted to contribute to the efforts, the aid efforts that were going on over the course of the summer. So there were all these new proposals for emergency refugee shelters. Many of them had quite striking or eye-catching features about them so that the press would pick them up. So maybe they were flat-packed shelters, maybe they could stack or be stored easily. There were lots of proposals that involved the reuse of existing buildings, the transformation of cheap shipping containers, for example, into new homes. You may remember the Venice Architecture Biennale in 2016, which contained a lot of these schemes all presented in quite expansive ways. And a lot of these interventions were also in urban areas. So I developed, I suppose, an academic interest in this moment of expansive new design, partly because I was a bit skeptical, and I'll probably say a bit more about that in a moment, but also because at the time I was looking for a new research project. And as you indicated in the introduction, I have this long-running interest in humanitarian design, in the way that aid workers define basic needs, and then the way that they measure those basic needs, how they sort through populations to prioritize people who are most in need, and then how they meet these needs, often with very technical procedures and seemingly innovative objects. So I had taken this approach to the previous book on humanitarian nutrition, which looked at how aid workers measure and manage hunger. And it seemed quite natural to move next to shelter. And when this explosion of interest in humanitarian design happened in 2015, it seemed like a good way to proceed. I should say also that I'm studying this very much as an anthropologist would study it, in the sense that I'm looking at aid workers and humanitarian designers and institutions as, in a way, having a distinctive culture, as having a particular approach to questions of human needs. And I'm asking that classic anthropological question, which is, why are they doing these things in the way that they're doing these things? So the project had these three research questions. Firstly, how were refugees being accommodated in different countries, particularly in Europe and the Middle East? That was my focus in the months and years after that crisis in 2015. So that was a descriptive question. My second one was an evaluative question, really. It was, well, what worked, what didn't work, and why? And I was interested here, particularly in the role of design as a way of solving humanitarian issues. And then my last research question was a bit more conceptual, and that was to ask, well, what actually is basic shelter? What are the most central, important components of this human need that everyone shares? So, how are you humanitarians making sense of the need for basic shelter and then responding to it? So, yeah, that was the starting point, and that was the basic structure of the research project that I started in 2015.
Well, thank you. I'm particularly interested in kind of these questions around design and kind of thinking about that question of sheltering and, how do you address these kinds of issues? And given that you approach this with an anthropological lens, I wanted to, sort of ask you then, how do you think designers can meet basic needs for shelter, particularly in sort of resource-poor settings that your work covers as well? And also because you were talking about, looking at that shelter question also within the urban context, I wanted to ask you in whether you thought that this issue becomes more complicated or these sort of interventions become more complicated to do in urban spaces.
Yeah, so they're good questions. And I think I should probably say at the outset that when I began the project, as I indicated a moment ago, I had a degree of skepticism. I had my doubts about the role that designers and architects can play in general, particularly about the refugee issue. I mean, there was this real outpouring of enthusiasm, and it's tricky sometimes to be cynical, but I basically wasn't convinced at the outset that architecture and design had much of a role in solving this deeply structural political problem. Because my attitude that had come out of the nutrition project was that you can't solve the underlying issues with a technical fix, basically. And if you want to provide refugee shelter successfully, you have to engage in the underlying political predicaments that caused the problem in the first place. So it seemed to me that there were all of these flashy ideas that were being publicized in the press, but design had actually very little to say or contribute about the root causes. For example, design can't make states invest in better welfare for refugees. It can't really help build the legal frameworks of protection. It can't counter the militarization of borders, or change public perceptions, or challenge discriminatory political discourse. So, to try and design your way out of these really structural problems seemed to me initially to be kind of missing the point. But that said, I did, as the project go on, become more and more open to what design could do. And in purely pragmatic terms, there were thousands, well, tens of thousands of people coming into cities around Europe who needed a roof over their heads, and they needed it quickly. So the challenge of the project became partly, well, how do we draw a boundary around what we think about basic shelter? And in a way, I discovered that there were lots of different ideas about what was basic that were knocking around. So the fundamental problem with responding to, just to come back to your question, in these kind of settings is in defining what's basic. Because if you're a humanitarian agency, then obviously you're limited, as you say, with resources, you're limited with time. But shelter is a very difficult thing to pin down. And if you start by saying, well, okay, we'll start by defining basic shelter as just a roof, something to keep off the rain, it doesn't seem like a very satisfactory answer. It's obviously not enough for people who have just arrived en masse in a city to say, well, a piece of corrugated iron or a piece of canvas is sufficient. Because as soon as you look at shelter, and in most humanitarian definitions, it becomes more and more expansive the more that you look at it. Because you don't just need shelter to keep off the rain, you need something to keep you warm. So you need insulation, you need something that's going to be sealed from the outside world. And then you need something that's going to provide privacy. You need a lockable door. You need security. You need enough space so people aren't just being crammed together like sardines or stacked up in dormitories next to each other. You need a place to wash. You need cleanliness. Good health is really crucial to most definitions of shelter. And then you get into other issues such as food, because you can't think about shelter without also thinking about food. This became one of the biggest issues with the shelters in that period. And that's before you even get to the need for community, because people expect to be able to continue to have communal life, quite rightly, and social life and cultural life. And then you need to think about schools and connections with the city and so on. And in the city, of course, as you indicate, a lot of these things get even more complicated because you have the planning complexities, the shared use, the existing rules and regulations, and so on. So, yeah, in the end, I focused on these seven different approaches, these seven different examples of shelter, many of which were in cities, and wanted to look at how they defined this basic need and responded to them. And I called the book Fragments of Home because each of them ended up just being very fragmented. A fragmented part of a bigger whole. They couldn't meet everything that was really required of shelter, so they ended up focusing on different things. I suppose the chapters were, some of them were focusing a bit more on the design, the universal designs, so the kind of things that the architects or designers aspired to be rolled out universally. And probably the best known example of that is the IKEA funded flat pack shelter, and that was my opening example. I looked at the model of building huge refugee camps in remote areas, particularly in Jordan. I studied a squat in Athens, which defined shelter very much as a form of politics, and that was a very different kind of model of looking at what people needed. There was an informal settlement in Lebanon, but the cases that related most closely to cities were those in Berlin and Vienna and Paris. And in all of those cases, the architects and designers were engaged in transforming existing buildings, empty buildings or abandoned sites, into these huge dormitories to provide as much shelter as possible for people in as short amount of space as they had. And probably the most iconic example was Tempelhof Airport in Berlin, where these huge aircraft hangars were installed with beds and bathrooms to house thousands of people over several years after 2015. And I think it was here that I saw the most important lesson about how you respond to these kind of situations. Because even though to some extent the intervention was successful in that it did get a roof over many people's heads, it prevented people from living on the streets. But the sheer size of these places meant that everybody's life had to be really closely regulated. The day was structured in a really formal and inflexible manner. And that meant that the overhead lights in the shelter were turned on at the beginning of the day and off at the end of the day, like clockwork. There were these fixed meal times. People couldn't make the food they wanted. They had to eat off institutional trays, canteen meals, for months, for years on end. They had to share rooms with many different people. They couldn't control the noise or the lighting. And all of this had a really profoundly damaging effect. So it led to my conclusion that the thing that is so often neglected in this push towards designing solutions is, in fact, the autonomy and desire and drive and wishes of the refugee inhabitants themselves.
I remember the description of Tempelhof in your book, which I thought was really quite shocking. The fact that people couldn't control something as basic as lighting in that space. And it's interesting that, so many people were sort of housed in this enormous space. And in a sense, it becomes a camp, doesn't it? And so I was wondering, in your view, having visited these different sites, both in the Middle East and also in Europe, do you think that there's a line between camps and cities, or where do you think that that line between the camps and cities can or are being drawn based on these interventions? Because this is sort of a this continues to be a debate, right, amongst a lot of scholars working on forced migration and practitioners as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very long-running debate. And it's also, as you say, an interesting question because in practice, you find the word camp being used to describe many of these places and settlements and design solutions, even though it's a word that I think many people don't like or certainly wouldn't want to be used. So Tempelhof itself was described as a camp, not just by its inhabitants, but by the people who work there. So you have all these very varied forms of accommodation being described as camps. And then alongside that, you also have this policy drive in the last few years to turn what we would classically describe as a camp, so those quite remote places in the desert, the ones in Jordan are the most classic examples, transforming those into cities as well. So there's a blurring of the line here. The way I would think of it is to say, well, there are lots of different definitions of camps in the scholarly literature, but they all have various shared features to them. They normally define camps according to space, according to the population that's in the camp, and according to the time frame of the camp itself. So in terms of space, camps are clearly bounded. In terms of populations, they're designed for a particular category of person who are being contained there, and containment is a really crucial part of the definition. And in terms of time, they're designed to be temporary. I mean, in reality, they often don't end up being temporary at all, but at least that's the intention at the moment that they're opened. And the thing is, you can carve out areas of a city that meet all of these elements of the definition. So Tempelhof Airport is a good example because it was very clearly bounded. It was surrounded by a fence, in fact, and it had checkpoints getting in and out. For the security of the refugees, it wasn't at least ostensibly to contain them, but that certainly seemed to be the feeling or the effect. The population, of course, was diverse in terms of nationality, but everybody was a non-citizen, everyone was asylum seeker, and they were being contained there really until a longer-term solution could be found. And in terms of time, yeah, the intention of Tempelhof was very much to be temporary. I mean, initially the idea was that people would only live there for a few months, and I suppose one can accept the kind of restrictions on daily life and the inability to cook your own food and turn on your own light and control your own noise for just a few weeks or months. But of course, there were some people who lived there for years. But anyway, these all camp-like features. But I think if you then look at cities, and you're the expert on cities, in fact, so I feel slightly uncomfortable talking about how we might define cities, but it's certainly there is a tension, or we can see a big distinction between the features, many features of cities, and these features of camps, not least because cities are so often a melting pot of different cultures and people, and they have a vibrancy and a depth that camps are never going to have, really, because they're designed for a specific class of non-citizens, and often tend to be more homogeneous. Cities are obviously permanent in as a fixture and often very dense, and camps, because they're temporary, often aren't, and they're often sprawling. And then culturally, cities tend to be places that people go to disappear or to build new lives or to leave behind their traditional ties and reinvent themselves. But camps have this feature of being extremely hierarchical, very controlling. Legibility is extremely prevalent in their design. The manager of one camp in Jordan famously said he wanted to be able to see from one end of the camp to the other so that everything could be known and all the activities there were visible to him. So I mean, I know that contemporary cities also have an awful lot of surveillance involved in them, but I think it doesn't quite meet the same criteria as the camp. So in many ways, this distinction seems to me to be a very important one. And this desire on the part of policymakers to turn camps into cities, while it's completely easy to understand why they want to do that, it often ends up being something of a rebranding exercise. Because camps have these core features to them, which means that they can never really truly become cities, not least because they're designed as temporary solutions for a particular category of people, in order to contain them. So it seems to me like that's a rebranding exercise. And it also seems to me that the best refugee shelter designs were those that tried to use certain features of the city to disrupt the camp. And the squat that I mentioned in Athens was a very good example of that one, because this was an attempt to occupy an empty building in the center of Athens and to create a self-governing community for citizens and non-citizens alike to live together. And it was a model that was explicitly rejecting the formal government-run camp model, because those camps were, in the traditional sense, very isolated, surrounded by fences, pushed to the edge of the city. And the whole model of trying to get people into the heart of the city and living together was a way of disrupting that kind of thinking. So anyway, I think that the distinction is an important one, and it does help us think through what works and what doesn't when it comes to shelter.
I'm going to ask a very provocative question here, which is, do you think that there is a role for aesthetics specifically in the design of shelter for displaced people?
Yeah, and I think my answer would be yes. But as I say, I began the project being very cynical about the role that, and when I say the role that the design could play, I do mean, yeah, particularly the role of aesthetics. But there is a danger, and I think that the best example of the dangers are the refugee shelter that I studied in Paris, in northern Paris, the so-called yellow bubble, as it was often called. And basically, this was a story when a well-known French architect was asked by the mayor of Paris to build a refugee shelter and to create something bold as a symbol of the mayor's compassionate intent. That was the way that it was framed, as a way to communicate that Paris was the city of the Enlightenment, and to build, I think literally in the brief, they were asked to build a refugee shelter that could be a signpost of humanity to the world. So the architects came up with this very striking design of an inflatable bubble, basically a plastic sheath that was kept up by a pump inside that maintained a slightly different air pressure. And it was erected in this decaying railway yard at the very north of Paris. And it was huge. It could be vis it was visible for miles around. And it was meant to be this sign of hope and joy. But because the aesthetics had been prioritized, I think it's a really good illustration of the dangers. And I suppose when aesthetics has a possibly damaging role in the world of refugee shelter, because the architecture became symbolic rather than practical. It didn't really contribute anything to the experience of the people who lived inside. In fact, it was pretty impractical. It was very hot and it was very sweaty and noisy inside the bubble. But also, it became, certainly in my analysis of it, a false symbol of hope, because the shelter had this also quite deeply political role towards clearing the streets of Paris of the migrant camps, which had become a big issue for many Parisian voters. So even though it was very visible and expressive, it also became a way to hide the problem. And once people were inside this facility, they were entered into the formal system of asylum. They were fingerprinted. They were sent off for processing, actually outside of Paris. So they were only able to stay in this place for 2 weeks, and then they were sent to various different centres around France, and this often eventually led to their deportation. It was described by some people as like a post box. It had this aesthetics that conveyed hospitality, and you posted people into it and you cleared the streets of the camps, but they ended up disappearing. It ended up getting rid of the problem. So there was this irony, because it was visible, but actually the effect was to make the migrants invisible and to send them off to other places. And it was in a way, a false symbol of compassion, I think, for that reason. It sorted through people and then dispatched them elsewhere. And I think a really good feature of that example was the fence. This facility was surrounded by a fence, but because the aesthetics of the project had such strong part in it, they wanted to turn the fence into a kind of artistic installation. And they took this colorful tape and wove it through the wire of the fence to produce something that looked a bit like Islamic lattice work. And I spoke to the designer, and they said explicitly they did this to make the fence feel less carceral. But again, it just seems like an example of when you look at aesthetics, it's dressing up something that is, by definition, carceral and turning it into something that resembles something else. So I think that's a very good illustration of the dangers of aesthetics. But I suppose I don't want to be entirely negative, because I did see examples of when aesthetics played a role. And I suppose the alternative to say that aesthetics don't matter at all would be to say that the internal quality of a space doesn't matter. And that takes us, I think, in a very negative direction, because of course the internal quality of a space matters. And just very briefly, I think the example that I studied that illustrates that best was in Vienna, where you had a group of architects who weren't trying to do something on the kind of bold symbolic scale that I saw in Paris, but really just trying to improve the quality of the internal space. And in that example, refugees were living in office blocks, which again were empty, and they were being turned into dormitories for refugees. All the same problems that we saw in Tempelhof were there. You couldn't control the lighting. It was this horrible strip lighting above that was on all day. Lots of people were sharing open plan offices, so they had no privacy. And the architects came up with this great idea of installing parasols within the open plan office, and then surrounding the parasols by blankets, and then giving individual lights and cushions. And it created these little enclaves of privacy within the office. It filtered the harsh lighting from above. It controlled the noise as well. And it was very cheap, and it wasn't a flashy intervention, really, but it was all about thinking about the aesthetics of the immediate surrounding space. And I think it was very effective. So I don't want to be entirely negative, but I think that does illustrate the role that aesthetics can and can't play successfully in this kind of an area.
I think that was a really nuanced response. So it's not that aesthetics isn't important, but also that there is, as you were saying, there's a danger that, excessive sort of emphasis on the design side of things or even the technical side of things tends to sort of hide the bigger politics, which really cannot be fixed through these kinds of interventions. But the systemic challenges are much more complicated than the technical fixes, so to speak. I wanted to sort of close with asking you, we started out with you talking about being an anthropologist and you've done this work on humanitarianism for quite some time, and now you went from kind of looking at the discussions around food to now looking at design. So I wanted to ask you then, as a non-architect and as an anthropologist who's studied architects and design in this particular context that is also very political and controversial, what did you learn about this world?
Well, I mean, it's a big question, but it was certainly a learning process doing this project. And as I say, I began with this degree of skepticism, which I think certainly softened because I understood, and I think you articulated it very well just then, about the different role that design and aesthetics can play in this field. And a lot depends on the scale, and a lot depends on the intention, and so on. I also learned that there is a big division between the world of architecture and design and the world of humanitarianism. It's obvious on the face of it, but so often when design comes into the world of aid, the differences in cultures between those two different fields is not necessarily focused on. And of course, the main difference in culture relates to pragmatism versus vision, or thinking about things, I suppose, as an engineer might, and thinking it much more expansively. But I guess there's also the big lesson that underpins this, which is that there was a lot of talk at the beginning in 2015 about what design could do. And it made sense that architects and designers wanted to contribute, but they very rarely talked about what design couldn't do. And I think that was really what I wanted to emphasize through the project, that the key challenge of design is trying to understand its limits. And a lot of those limits is when it attempts to grapple with politics. And if you want to improve shelter, you have to engage in that very basic and very sad fact that many governments and individuals have an interest in excluding refugees or keeping them in a liminal, precarious state, or it not investing in good quality shelter. And the tendency to triumphantly celebrate what design can do often risks obscuring the political projects that are going on underneath. And in the end of the book, I conclude, I suppose not very anthropologically, I'll confess, but with the suggestion that a principle of autonomy could make a difference in the way that designers approach this issue. Because in all of the cases that I studied, the element of shelter that wasn't really being paid attention to was the emphasis that the inhabitants themselves were most concerned about. And that was often their ability to shape their life in very immediate ways, often in very small and insignificant ways. For example, cooking the food that they wanted to eat and being able to host family and friends, and even being able to close the door and lock the door and turn the light on and turn the light off. And these are not very big, sexy design problems. They're very everyday problems, but it was autonomy over the small things. It was control over those immediate circumstances of life that really seemed to make the difference between the good and bad cases that I had studied. So I suppose that was the lesson that I drew and wrote into the book, but I also had my own personal journey, I suppose, of realizing what the role of design could and couldn't be.
I think that's a really nice way to sort of encapsulate those differences because it's interesting how that divide sort of happens that with humanitarianism or with people who work in the humanitarian sector, their priorities are quite different to sort of the way and the ways in which they're trained as well, I feel are different to the ways in which you would be trained and how you would see these kinds of questions around design and aesthetic as an architect. And that ultimately, then also are political questions. Who are you designing for? What are the politics behind the ways in which people are seen? And, are these populations that are to be managed, or are they clients? And that makes a big difference as well in terms of the resources you have, what can be done, how you treat people. So there's a lot that goes on that's embedded within different philosophies of how different groups of people are also approached. Thank you for being on the podcast and talking to us today, and also for the fantastic work that you've been doing over the years. So I would encourage everybody who's listening to this to read them. Thanks so much for your time today, Tom.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.